Welcome, guys. It's the market sniper, Francis Hunt, bringing you a very welcome guest in. A retiree working out of Switzerland, was engaged in the wealth management industry, Clive Thompson. Clive, how are you?
Hello, Francis. Nice to meet you. It's a frosty, cold day here in Geneva. How about where you are?
It's always balmy and warm. I choose it that way. It's always balmy and warm, even when I'm traveling. But thank you. Yes, I love a good old ski holiday. But other than that, I scamper away from the cold. It's more the gray that gets me down, I think. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we've got enough gray to talk about in terms of the larger financial markets. And what I've really liked is since a very interesting appearance you made alongside Mario a while ago that brought you first into my periphery of vision, you've actually advanced some of your thoughts. So the engagement process of others, maybe some criticism, some feedback, some new news, has actually seen you develop further out on how the whole reset financials go down. I'm really keen to get your take. Tell us about how, for those that might have missed the original video on another channel, maybe your foundation work and how it's moved on since then.
So we've got two things which are going to come. One is the central bank digital currency, the CBDC, and we are also going to have, but not necessarily at the same time, what's called a currency reset. A currency reset is absolutely necessary because most Western governments are massively over-indebted. As interest rates rise, the interest cost to them is spiraling out of control, and they won't be able to pay the interest except by massive inflation. And that's liable to create a panic. When these kinds of situations have happened historically, countries have abandoned their old currency in favor of a new currency. So the premise I had on Mario's show was that when the CBDC comes, they might use that as an opportunity to launch a new currency, abandoning the old one. I said maybe quickly, but I think it'll be more of a slow abandonment with the two, the CBDC and the old currency, running side by side for a period so that people can get used to it. Because it will take a while for people to get used to the CBDC when it comes. That's the digital wallet you'll have, which is a liability of the central bank, not of your own bank. And at some point, if there is a crisis after the CBDC is here, it's likely they're going to tell you, sorry, there's a limit as to how much of your old currency you can put into your CBDC wallet. And by the way, you could only spend CBDCs now in the shops. You have to pay your taxes in the CBDCs, your salaries in the CBDCs, and so on. And then you'll be left behind with a bunch of old bonds, old cash in your bank account, not all of which you'll be able to use on one day. Now, how, to what extent they'll persuade people that you'll be able to convert later, we'll wait and see. But I think if you have a large amount...
What promises they'll make that they plan to break is very much so, the same. Before I let you go too much on, it's kind of a wither on the vine strategy for the old, isn't it? Create a bottleneck where you can't get the, you know, it's almost like a toll road where you have these lanes taper and then there's pay booths and everybody either pays extra to get through or they start queuing and the big 16-wheelers get stuck and have to pay more, et cetera, et cetera. So they create a bottleneck, wither the old on the vine, and then they start activating and launching new initiatives that requires the new. So you find yourself sitting holding some old eggs going off and then having some fresh produce in the other hand almost, and wanting to know what, how do you put down the old and get out of it? So that challenge, how's that going to play? Tell us more on that.
Well, that's exactly how I see it. I think that to give confidence to the new currency, they'll tell you you can convert the old one to the new one. But at some point, when the panic comes, they'll bottleneck it, as you said. That I think that's the best word. And at that point, the old currency is going to be trading at a discount. People will still believe that the day will come when they can convert it to the new one, and therefore it will have a value, but it will be 100 cents on the dollar. My guess is the day they bottleneck it, it'll drop to 70 cents on the dollar on that day, and I'm betting 3 months later you'll be lucky to get 20 cents on the dollar for it. Yeah. So I think that's coming.
So they're going to taper everybody into a mega loss, basically. And the game is bridging what you have now, which will be old soon at that key point when they do the introduction, arcing it over to something that can be brought back into the new realm without having to eat the capital gains loss that they're going to feed everybody. So how does gold and precious metals fit into that? Because surely that's something that's still the same thing, regardless what people do at an accounting level and at a news media level.
Well, one of the things that we have to remember if we go into a new currency, or if the old currency just ceases to be of any value and we have a new one, is that whatever you own as a possession, whether it be a gold bar, a gold coin, a silver coin, or a bar of chocolate, it will still be that.
Yes.
Someone's still going to give you value in the new currency for that. So it doesn't matter if your bar of chocolate costs sixpence in the old currency or sixpence in the new currency. And now it might be £100 in the old currency and sixpence in the new currency, but it will still have the value of a bar of chocolate. Same thing for a piece of gold or a silver coin or a property or an animal or a farm or land or tools, or anything you might happen to earn, firewood, things you might earn, which is still valuable.
Yes. So the physical things technically sound like they are part of the solution potentially in that. And the digitized old, it's what I love about this potential, because I've done the same scenario casting exercise, is what they're going to be actually selling us is probably a blockchain-based central bank digital token, as you've suggested, which is re-digitizing us. But in some ways, the defense is to be not digitized going into this. So they're actually going to undermine the concept of digitization to bring out a second version of some form of digitized asset. And the game is for arcing over this chasm that will suddenly appear at a news-driven event is actually to not be digitalized. So part of what I've been saying is de-digitalization. Is that this reset concept? Do you concur with that, and what caveats, and how would you color that out further?
Well, first of all, there's going to be many, many countries who will bring in digital currencies. I think I read somewhere it's more than 100 companies or countries are working on it. Each one will have its own way of doing it and its own things. But certainly the question of things like the equivalent of a hard fork or a soft fork of the old currency is possible, where you have two types of the new currency. You have a new digital currency, but that could be forked into two types. One type if you're doing certain types of transactions, and another type for another type of transactions. There's all sorts of possibilities here. I think the main thing is the digital currency will, to all intents and purposes, be programmable, which means they'll be able to, for example, pay you an interest rate instantaneously or charge you an interest rate. They'll be able to deduct taxes instantaneously. I can see, for example, they might say
real-time taxation.
Yeah. I mean, there might be an emergency situation. They say, we've decided to take every digital cent ending in the letter E. It belongs to us now as a one-off emergency tax. Or they might say, here's your universal basic income of $500 a month or whatever it is, but you've got to spend it. And if you don't spend it, you'll lose it. And they'll give you a month or 2 months to spend it. There's all kinds of things you can do.
And they'll control what you spent it on as well. They'll probably control exactly what it can be spent on. It'll categorize. I don't know if they'll be a big fan if you rush off to your bullion dealer with it, for example, but they might be okay if you go to Amazon.com and make purchases there.
So I wonder what they'll say if I go to my fortune teller and she says, cross my palm with silver, because I better have some silver to do that.
Indeed. Smart fortune teller, I would say. She's seen the future. Indeed. Excellent. I love it. Please carry on. In terms of, so we're also discussing the solution as you're rolling out this element. There's going to be social unrest in all of this mix, isn't there? There's going to be something oppressive. What's the nature of this? Because this is not only a fiscal and a financial. This is going to be a social upending. This is going to be a preeminence of the watermelon communism, the greenwash, isn't it? How's those elements? What do you see in all that?
Well, I think in general, currency resets come when the crisis has started. The currency reset might in itself create a crisis, but the way I would see it is there's a panic somewhere. Perhaps, for example, the government bond market is crashing and it's spiraling out of control, and confidence has been lost in the currency, and they have to take action. It might be that people are rioting in the streets because they don't like their electricity bills or they can't buy enough food. It might be that everybody has decided to queue up at the shops and get all the foods out, the food out, and the shop shelves are empty, and they have to stop people hoarding this food by limiting how much they can spend. There's many, many possibilities, and we can't actually know in which way it'll play out. But certainly the ideal plan they have is everything will carry on as before. They'll kick the can down the road and nobody will notice they continue to inflate the currency system, and people will become more and more accustomed to using the new digital currency, even though the old currency is running alongside, hopefully at the time on a one-to-one basis, but at some point they cut it off and it's not one-to-one anymore.
They're going to want to punish cash holders. As much as I suggest people holding cash notes, they are going to want to punish cash holders. So that'll still be captured in the old, even if you have it. At least you'll be safe and people will accept it out of legacy. But at some point, it's going to get tapered too, isn't it?
I don't think I'd use the word punish, but I'm going to put it differently.
Yeah.
When the digital currency or reset comes, the government will write rules to decide who the winners and who the losers are. Yeah. Clearly, if you're foreign, you're not going to get as favorable treatment as a domestic citizen. If you are extremely wealthy, you're not going to get the favorable treatment that a poor man is going to get. If you happen to be a foreign government, like the government of China holding T-bills, you're not likely to get a particularly favorable treatment, although there'll be lots of promises made, I have no doubt. So I personally think the man in the street will be just fine. He would. So if we talk about 80, 90% of the population, he's going to shrug his shoulders and say, well, I didn't have any money. I've lost nothing. They've converted what I had. I had 5,000 or 500. They've converted that, and I get my salary in the new currency. I think the man in the street won't be bothered, and he's pretty much accustomed to privacy being invaded. You know, you go into a program these days and it tells you all about privacy concerns and cookies and God knows what, and you click, okay, accept. That's what we do. So I don't think the man in the street's going to be too bothered. Of course, there'll be plenty of privacy advocates who say this new digital currency is absolutely terrible, but they probably, there'll be a voice. They'll be in the minority. And there will be people who have large cash balances and lose out because they have a large cash balance. They've received an inheritance, they've sold a house, and they're going to be complaining about like blue murder, but they won't be in the majority. I think if you're a pensioner and you have a pension fund, there'll be a bailout for the pension funds because when the government does a reset, we mustn't forget they're leaving behind their old liabilities in an old currency that they no longer need to service in the currency which is being used on a day-by-day basis in the economy, the new currency. So they're not bothered what happens to the old debt. They can effectively start from a debt to GDP ratio of zero, meaning they've got no debt in the new currency. So they can incur some debt immediately to bail out the pension plans, the domestic pension plans, and look after their pensioners. They can also start doing a universal basic income without having too much debt. You know, the kind of debt levels we've got already are more than 100%. No matter what they do, it'd be almost impossible to get to that level of debt. You know, they bail out every citizen in the country. So I don't think there'll be anybody who's impoverished by this, but certainly there'll be some wealthy individuals, companies, and organizations who had a lot of cash or had a lot of bonds and find that they can't use that anymore, or they need permission to use it in the old currency for the new currency.
Unless, of course, they're World Economic Forum-friendly corporations with CEOs in Davos, then maybe there will be a conversion tool for them. I wonder. I have a feeling this is the corporates, actually. The big corporates might get away a little better. It's more, though, the personal wealth. Your ex-clients at a personal wealth level that were maybe small-level entrepreneurs, people maybe like you and I, that might have a reasonable balance sheet and wealth and may have pension liabilities. Well, we owed a pension and have maybe some T-bills that will get the worst hit and have the worst. And you know, when you mention the pensioners, I think they look at who's also, if I look at the events of COVID and how things got treated. I have a feeling that, and care homes in the UK, the kind of stuff that went down, that the pensioners might get slighted somewhat. They will get something in lieu, but it may not feel like the full pint that they had before, if you may. It may look like it's been passed down the bar and everybody's had a swig out of it and then they've got what's left. I don't know if they're going to get made entirely whole. Well, it won't be patently obvious at the first essence. So there's going to be behind the curtain magician pulling out rabbits out of hats and a waving of a wand. And by the time they've actually realized, which will take us a period of dawning before that purchasing power. What do you think about that? Or am I just being particularly malicious of thought?
Well, I share your view. First of all, there's going to be a lot of very, very complex situations immediately after reset, and they'll be writing laws as fast as they can to deal with all these complex situations. As far as the pensioners are concerned, I also agree that there's going to be a bailout for the pensioners, but it won't be necessarily 100% for everybody. So if you have a pension coming in of £500,000 a year, that would be a very, very large one, I don't think you're going to be getting that much under the new system. Whereas if you have a pension coming in of £10,000 a year, you probably find you're as good as made whole. Now, that's where the barrier will lie and how they'll write the rules. We'll wait and see. And don't forget, in each country, they'll write different rules according to their own situation. So it will be
your model has a bit of a socialism in it, that it's going to be a half step to communism haircut on a needs basis. You know, you're the lone spouse now, your wife has died, you had a half a million pension. Well, the truth be told, you only need 80,000 a year to live very, very well, and the guy on 10,000, he gets 9 of his 10, a very minor haircut, while you could be deemed still to have got some value, but lost the most. It's kind of a socialist concept where there's a panel that is giving the better off a bigger shave.
If we look back in history, there have been countless currency resets ever since the beginning of history. Almost every currency which ever existed doesn't exist. So the number of currencies which exist today, a few hundred of them, are the minority. There's been tens of thousands of currencies which have gone before and have been effectively reset. When the reset comes, it's always those who've got the largest cash balances or, I'm going to say bonds. Obviously, bonds didn't exist in the old days, but people had debt instruments where they were owed money. They were always the loser because they were owed money in a currency which either ceased to exist immediately or was withering away.
I agree.
Give you an example. In Germany in 1948, the Western zones, the French, American, and British zone, allowed the Germans, who were to a large extent using cigarettes as their barter currency, but they did have marks. They allowed them to change their marks into the new Deutschmark, but you only got one-on-one, let's say, for the first 100 Deutschmarks. The next 100 Deutschmarks was 60, and the next 100 Deutschmarks was 6. So a lot of the old currency, even though it was fairly worthless, was left behind in the old currency.
Yeah. Very clever. Tapering and squeezing the better off. Fascinating. So what do you do? How do you defend for that, apart from the physical options? What's your thoughts on this line of action?
I think it's sensible to, first of all, I want to stress, I am not suggesting anyone gets rid of all their cash. That would be the last thing I will do, last thing anyone should do. You never know when you're going to need cash. First of all, you don't know when this is going to happen. When it happens very quickly, so you've got no time to move. But you don't want to get rid of all your cash because you might have emergencies where you need cash. You might, depending on your situation, if you have a salary, it's one situation. If you don't have a salary, it's a completely different situation. But you need to have cash because you need to spend money, and you don't know if you'll need to spend more money next month or next year than you do this year. So keep some cash in reserve. That would be my first comment. In preface to what I'm about to say, my second comment is, don't try and game the system by leveraging up on debt and borrowing as much as you can to put into the assets like gold or silver, if that's the way you want to go, because One, you'll be seen as a pariah of the system by those who didn't do that. They're going to say, this guy took advantage of what he knew. The newspapers are going to be against you, and I'm quite sure governments are going to be looking for a large windfall tax on those who they see unjustly benefited from the currency reset. And of course, there will be people who know it's coming before it happens, and those people, some of them, will certainly be taking advantage of the situation. I don't think they're going to be looked at in a favorable light. But there are other risks if you leverage up.
On that point, will we kind of be apartheid, just before, if you can hold that thought, apartheid of debt? In other words, government debt and government debt instruments are handled in one way, but retailers that maybe max a credit card out and then go buy gold as an instrument, for example, they could get seen in a far poorer light. So could that be an example? How can we have a sort of duality in debt? Because not all debt is the same, is it? And it's not all the same issue, quite clearly. I'd like to explore that a little bit before you go to your next point.
So if we go back historically, those who took advantage of the system historically actually got away with it. But I didn't think that would be the case this time. So, you know, if we go back in history, let's say we had the Brazilian reset, I can't remember what it was, about 1980. If you would have taken your money out of the bank and bought gold, you'd have been just fine. Those who failed to do it suddenly found that their bank balance was forcibly, against their wishes, loaned to the government for the next few years. By the time they got it back in the old currency, it was completely worthless. So we have to be careful about, or anybody who's going to try and take advantage of the situation. In the new world, that information will be much more visible to the governments, the newspapers, than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago, when information didn't flow in the way it does today. If I just step back to another risk, if you take out debt.
Just on that point to explore, what's to stop? Say I have credit lines that I could raise $500,000 at a private person's level, as Francis. And I went and did all that and then did bulk physical buy of precious metals. Would that, and then a reset came within 3 months after that. How'd they get me down? How'd they take that? How do you think that they...
Well, one of the things which I think might happen is a timing situation where they decree that all debts taken out in the previous 3 months or 6 months are converted to the new currency. So you're liable in the new currency, whereas anything more than 3 or 6 months old is left behind. That's a possibility.
Yeah.
And you must also remember, Francis, if you do load up on debt before a reset,
interest rate,
there's a risk that we run into a crisis. People are selling government bonds, and your government, your bank says, look, the assets you bought are worth less than what we've lent you. We'd like our money back. And you're forced to sell out at the worst possible moment.
Yeah, forced sellout. I would never encourage anyone to do that. I was just exploring how it may go. And the interest rate, I warn that interest rates are these Trojan controlled demolition explosives on your financial structure, that you just need a very short spike. And you'll remember, as do I, people wanting to sell their houses during the George Soros attack on the British pound. You know, when we had massive spikes, they were wrecked, basically, in within hours, in a single minute. And most people can't conceptualize such a drama and such vastness having to be take place. So we've got to go through that whole currency crisis where any level of debt could in fact turn into your financial destruction. And I part feel that they really need that, because the UBI, most people are quite cynical or skeptical about it, that have any kind of meritocracy at heart. But the best way to ensure everybody signs up for it is to have hollowed as many people out. And most people, particularly in the UK property market, and we're considering other markets, of course, there's a debt aspect to that. So an interest rate spike, I'm almost putting down as a 9 out of 10 possible likelihood across most currencies. I don't know, where do you stand on that as well?
Well, I think it's a high probability because the crisis will be in part when they have to reset, brought about by a loss of confidence in the currency. That means higher interest rates, or a loss of confidence in the bond market. That means higher interest rates, or a rush to dispose of your money into anything else, which means higher interest rates. So no matter which way you look at it, it seems very, very likely that ahead of the reset, we'll see interest rates being pushed up with the central bank.
It's disorderly fashion.
Trying to control them.
Sorry, to keep cutting in. In a disorderly fashion, though. They're not as in, we've already seen quite a steep climb, but something that further that is far more dramatic and instantaneous, almost like the British pound experiment. Not even Jay Powell's four in a row, 0.75 quite cuts it. A disorderly spike.
Now we must remember there is the central bank can always control interest rates by throwing money at the system. They can buy bonds of any maturity and lend it out short term at any interest rate they like, keeping the rates down. But if they do that, and when the market is against them, it will destroy the currency. And you touched on George Soros. That's effectively what happened in Great Britain. They were doing everything they could to try and hold the pound in the exchange rate mechanism, and they were struggling. And then as things started to get out of control, the Bank of England started to raise the interest rates. Boom, 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 boom. I think it even went up maybe three times or two times in one day to some phenomenal rate. And finally, the market was bigger than the Bank of England. And they broke the Bank of England, or rather broke the pound. The pound collapsed by about 30% against the dollar, maybe a bit less against the Deutschmark. And then they could bring the interest rates back down the next day.
In terms of potentially building wealth through this event, it's going to be very, very hard. If you were someone who had, say, puts with a big broker, say in the US, on bond instruments, and this interest rate spike happens, and of course debt is devalued and rates have shot up, and you've made technical profits, how much of the counterparty risk, what's the likelihoods of actually coming out a winner by being, we had Michael Burry, you know, popularized in The Big Short, the film, with regards to subprime. Is there a trade yourself to wealth in this position? How big is the counterparty risk reset going to be that you actually even get to keep anything you get if you're that too smart guy that's put on the trade?
Unlikely. If you are an individual putting up on a trade and your counterparty is the big boys, which it will be, you are unlikely to get to keep your profit. And that's probably because the big boys will be part of the club writing the rules. So we only have to look at what happened in the London metals market last year in nickel. The exchange was on the line to pay the winners who were long nickel. But the exchange couldn't collect the money, or didn't know it could collect the money from the loser, the one who was short nickel. So what did they do? They cancelled all the trades. Bam.
Unbelievable.
They're now being sued by, I think it's Glencore. But anyway, they're being sued for having cancelled those trades illegally. But they rewrote the rules, basically. So this is what's likely to happen if the big boys are losing money because lots of people have put on trades which make them lose too much money. Somehow the rules are going to get rewritten and they'll say, sue us.
I love that you point that out, and I have that inherent cynicism within me. I don't know if you recall the Euro Swiss franc. We felt the peg was going to fail. It was our second short call on that. And there was, of course, liquidity providers, and a number of brokers actually gave people stops because they had the stop just below the peg level that they then restated after the liquidity providers just pulled complete bidless market. And then restated substantially down so that they'd essentially not only obliterated the entire retail holder's account, but that he actually owed substantial seven-digit sums to the broker for a fill, one of the worst fills in history on a trade, once they decided, well, the first trade was actually down here. We didn't execute your stop loss as we originally closed your trade. In fact, you're now minus X hundred. Please make arrangements to make your account whole. Our people are getting in touch. And that's another example. And those same liquidity providers are indeed the same parties you're referring to that would be the counterparties to any puts on bonds that you would show up for and look for your profits on. So is it a fool's errand to be looking for any form of gain out of this process in terms of the trading paper derivative contract mechanisms. I'm not talking about physical instruments like gold and silver. I'm talking about actual being a trader and contracts.
Yeah, yes, it's a fool who tries to do that. Well, I wouldn't. I'm not going to say he's a fool. I mean, why not try? I will not be doing it. I think I will not try because I think that I'll be screwed over if I do it. One thing I've learned about all kinds of derivatives is it never ends up where you want it to end up. And the other thing is there's a God up there, and that's the big boys, who are watching what you do. They know what you've done, and they're going to make the price or the expiry come at a time which is worst for you and best for them. People are unlikely to make money by putting on all sorts of derivative trades. And we mustn't forget, the government is going to write a lot of rules after the event, so things will not be how you imagine they will be.
I mean, they did the beautiful part, the most beautiful part of the film I'm referencing, I'm not sure if you've seen it, is that he was continually trying to get hold of Goldman Sachs. So Burry had actually shorted the worst slice of the subprime, that just a 4 or 5% drop in property markets would render them virtually valueless. And he kept contacting Goldman Sachs for his bid to price, and they kept it at mark to market. They said it's still one, it's still parity. And they said, oh, and we've upped the cost of holding the position. And they were trying to liquidity squeeze him out of being able to hold the trade. And he then wrote to all his investors and said, no one can withdraw from the fund. And they had he had a full mutiny, and a few anchor investors that came to his office and demanded their money back, and that he'd lost his touch and all of this. And he just kept insisting, no, no, no. And eventually he actually got to win, but he had such liquidity and he had shorted the absolute rot. And there's that, the film ends almost with the lady from Goldman Sachs 3 weeks later, after Goldman had insured that loss and passed it on to AIG, saying, oh, Mr. Burry, I know you've been trying to get hold of us for the last month. We're proud to announce that we can give you an up-to-date mark. And then whole thing, until that hot potato had been shifted onto a state-based backup, which was essentially backing AIG, they were not going to let him have any profit. And because they controlled that market, they continued to assert it was still valued the same as when he put the trade on. And that is a sample of exactly what you're saying. He happened to have a happy ending, but the duress he withheld and withstood was phenomenal.
Well, there's countless stories out there where the big boys have screwed people over. And I have personal stories where I've been screwed over by the likes of the European Central Bank, for example, when they had the Greek crisis. They forced a change in the rules related to Greek bonds so that they could effectively vote for themselves. So the ECB got paid out 100%, and those who were expecting to perhaps collect 40 cents on the dollar didn't get their 40 cents on the dollar. They got much, much less, because all of the rewritten rules provided that a 30% holder, the ECB, could get 100%.
Ridiculous.
As an example.
Yeah, that's thievery.
Another example, I don't know if anyone has ever done a derivative on gold where you have a stop loss, or effectively a stop loss. You'll probably have seen that sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, New Zealand time, on an exchange which has virtually no contracts at all, it hits a price at which nobody trades, but your stop loss is taken out.
100%. In fact, they do this algorithmically. I've got a very short anecdote because there's so much more to explore. But I had exactly that event on a stock, and they had an algorithm. And I said, there was no trade. They took me out. And I even got the LSE stats and sent it to them. And they spike dipped and ran my stop. I said, there was no trade at that level. You cannot take me out. And you couldn't have done all these things. I had this argument. And it became explained that the algorithm has, and it was just for a second as well. That was, so it was a flash crash within
a microsecond.
And I ended up getting the full explanation, and I demanded my money back, and I actually got the trade cleared. I was lucky there. But they have an algorithm, and a guy who had a bid high up withdrew it to put it up even higher. And they took that bid being removed from the stack as negative, flash crashed it, ran my stop, took me out, and then he replaced it in the time it took to resubmit the order higher up. And they never corrected for that trade, and they shook me out. That was a liquidity element as well. But anyway, fascinating. I mean,
if that's legal, which one can argue about the question, it's very easy for these banks to see ways they can make money by running a price down, taking out all the stop losses, and running it back up before you've got a chance to buy the lower prices. It's whether it's legal or not, I don't think the regulators have got time to deal with it. They've got lots of other things to deal with because there's lots of criminality they can deal with without having to run after the small, petty losses that the small...
Retail traders' losses. They're not going to worry for us. And I think in reset season, there's going to be such chaos and such destruction of records, likely, that many a crime will be committed at the top tier, not by you, that will go without even a look or a prosecution. It's going to be an event of great chaos for which a large amount of records will likely be lost. Anyway, you've got some interesting charts to share us. We were talking about insuring American debts. I think you had something interesting to show us there, didn't you?
Okay, so we're looking here at the level of US government debt to GDP since the Second World War. And you can see that the level of debt to GDP is the highest ever, and America is not at war with anybody. Not at least on the battle zone. So anything, if we go back to after the 2008 banking crisis, the level of debt had risen, we're talking about here, roughly here, where my mouse is.
Yeah,
so roughly getting on for 100%. And Ben Bernanke, who was chairman of the Fed, was speaking before Congress, and they were asking about this. And he said, well, look, you have a plan called the Debt Reduction Plan to bring the debt to GDP ratio down from 100%, or wasn't 100% yet, but it was in the direction of 100%, down to this level, the 60% level. Why, about now or next year? That was where it was going to come to, where my mouse is. As you can see, it's gone the wrong direction. It's showing here on this particular chart at 129% going on 130%. So US government is right now in a situation where if the interest rates go up as they are, that debt is going to spiral out of control because the cost of financing the interest will be much, much higher. So I'm just running through this. This is a chart I saw recently, the cost of insuring US government debt against a default. Now, you see the huge spike up in the last few days. That's caused by the fact that the US government has hit its debt ceiling, and now there'll be many months of negotiation in the two parties of Congress to try and raise that debt ceiling. They've done it 90 times before. Everyone thinks they'll do it.
I was about to say, could it be different this time? Because everybody assumes this is political theater and that there's never a sticky end to one of these things. It's just a case of, they'll make a big song and of a dance. And I wonder, people are this peak complacency about this ceiling story. This is probably one of the most intense positions the finances have ever been in.
It could be different. If I go back to that chart, the percentage probability of the USA defaulting is currently a little bit more than 0.5%, a 1 in 200 chance. That's not a high probability, but it is very, very high compared with what it was. It's about 5 or 6 times the probability of, say, the UK defaulting, which we all know is not the most brilliant situation itself. That's the way they're pricing it in. And, if I...
Sometimes the trend is more meaningful than the value, the current value. And that's a very nasty little spike.
Yes. So we'll see how it opens up on Monday. There's a little chart to show you the probability of the 5 year, this is the 5 year debt defaulting. You can see the United Kingdom not very high, but the United States, it's halfway down. United States, it's 0.54% probability of default is where they're pricing the 5 year debt at the moment. That's a pretty high probability for a country like the United States. So what's the United States doing about it? Well, first of all, they've still got cash in the bank that can last for a number of months, and they can keep spending that money. But they're going to have to cut down on some things. And if we look at what Janet Yellen has said they're doing, I think you'll find that quite surprising. I'll just jump to her letter here. Just give me a second. There we are. Oops, go back. This is the letter from Janet Yellen dated 19th of January to Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker of the House. I'll read the section, which I put a ring around in case people can't see it on their iPhone. It says, with these determinations, the Treasury Department will suspend additional investments of amounts credited to and redeem a portion of the investments held by the Civil Service Retirement and Disability Fund. In other words, step one, they stop paying into the government pension plan. Step two, in the same words, redeem a portion of the investments held by the retirement fund. So they're going to raid the pension plan. That's how I read it.
And the state workers' pension plan. So they can't. The first step is to get the one that they essentially control, not private pensions, but that'll be next.
And of course they've got other things they could do, such as shutting down the national parks, sending workers home without pay, asking them to work without pay. There's all sorts of things they could do. And if we read the rest of the letter, she goes on to say, once the debt ceiling is raised. It says we will make, once it's raised again, they will remake the pension fund whole again, and retirees and employees will be unaffected by these actions.
So that's their overdraft, their emergency overdraft, which they'll then allege to pay off in much the same way Bernanke said at 80% debt to GDP, he was going to take it to 60%, only it ended up at 120%. So eventually they fail in their good intentions. Yeah. I think my father always used to say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Yeah. These declarations and promises. Fascinating. What else did you have in there? Why were we looking at a Dairy Milk chocolate bar? A bit of inflation?
If you look at the price, for those who are not British, the number 6D is 6 pence, but it's the old pence where we had 240 pennies to the pound. With a pound, this was when I was a child, and I'm going to tell you a little story about that in a second. When I was a child, you could buy 40 of these bars of chocolate with a pound.
What?
Show me where you could buy a bar of chocolate for a pound today. Probably not one of these bars of chocolates anyway. Now, little story. When I was about 6 years old, I would say, I went to my grandfather's house in Wales, and he had some friends around. He put on the table a bar of chocolate just like this one and a £1 note. And he basically said, what would you like, Clive? The £1 note or the bar of chocolate? Now, being a six-year-old, I took the bar of chocolate, and all of his friends burst out laughing. They thought, you know, what a silly boy. He could have had a pound and bought 40 bars of chocolate, or words to that effect. And it was explained to me that the pound was worth more than the chocolate, but I got the chocolate anyway, and I was happy enough with that. A few years passed, maybe I was 8 years old now, and to amuse his friends again, he put down on the table the bar of chocolate, the £1 note, and a gold sovereign. A gold sovereign, you may know, is about a quarter of an ounce or a bit less than that, and said to me, Clive, which one would you like? So, being a smart cookie now, I didn't take the coin, I took the pound note. because I can buy more chocolate with the pound note. And he then proceeded to tell me I should have taken the sovereign because it's sound money. And even though a sovereign is a pound, you couldn't buy a sovereign for a pound. By the way, they didn't make those sovereigns anymore by then. They stopped producing them at that point many, many years before, but he had one. His friends didn't get it because they didn't understand what a sovereign was or what gold was. I mean, nobody understood it back then. My grandfather worked for HMRC, so he was quite familiar with investments of various kinds. So he understood what a sovereign was, whereas the other people in the room didn't. But anyway, he went on to explain what I suppose is Gresham's law. I mean, I was very young, so I didn't get it, but I guess he was explaining that the, now do we say that the bad money drives out the good and other people keep the good money? That's probably what he explained to me, but I didn't get it. But he gave me this gold sovereign back then, and I suppose it was worth £3 or £4 back in 1964, whatever it was. But he gave it to me when I was more like 14 and told me to keep it forever. So I still have it today. When I was 18 years old and working in the City of London, I went along to Sharps Pixley, the gold dealers, and showed them my sovereign and asked them how much it's worth. And they said, well, we'll give you £10 for it, but if you want to buy another one, you can have another one for £25. That sounded like a bad deal both ways to me.
Yeah.
So I kept my sovereign. And anyone who's got a sovereign will know it's worth, I don't know, £300-400 these days.
Yes, I was about to say, it's going to be on about $500 without any numismatic value alone, just on intrinsic.
Yeah, so what I'd like to show you here,
go back to sharing,
go back to sharing. You can see that now. I'd like to just show you, let me just click over here, sorry. What has happened to the value of the British pound? Here we have a chart, which I did on Sunday. It shows how many ounces of gold you could have bought with £10,000 back in 1971. In 71, you could have bought 635 ounces of gold.
And there's a reason you chose that. Yeah. Do remind everyone.
So in 1970, up until 1971, the whole world was on a dollar standard and the dollar was on a gold standard. So dollars were gold, gold was dollars. So that was the year that the gold price started free floating. So we could have bought 635 ounces with 10,000. By the year 2000, that's nearly 30 years later, you could only buy one-tenth of the amount, 63.5 ounces with your 10,000. And if we step forward now only 20 years later, you can only buy about, it says 6.5 here, but it's actually about 6.35. So it's one-tenth of that. So what we see is, you can look at it one way and saying the gold price has gone up, but actually the reality is the money has gone down. And it's not just the pound. You can take any currency you like on the planet and the picture is similar. The degree may have changed. It's the dollar hasn't devalued as much, but it's still, in terms of direction of travel, very, very close. So what's happening is the currencies of the world are all falling in value all the time and constantly. And the reason for that is the government is spending more money than they collect in taxes. It's called a budget deficit. Happens year after year. For example, this year, the US government spent, this is the year just passed, $6.3 trillion, but only collected $4.9 trillion in taxes. So where does the difference come from? They borrowed from the Federal Reserve. And where does the Federal Reserve get it? They print it. So more, it's like sand on the beach. There's more and more money on the planet day by day. So if you have a bank balance, your share of the total money on the planet is going down every day. And there's someone else who's got more of it, and they're going to bid up the price of that Van Gogh painting or that property you want to buy or that bar of gold or whatever it is, or even shares of Apple or whatever company is the flavor of the month. They're going to bid it up to a higher price than it was before because there's more money on the planet and they're going to put that money somewhere. And you are left behind holding your stale balance, which is barely rising except by a mediocre interest rate, which is way below the pace of printing.
Yeah, that's a beautiful chart. Thank you for sharing. And essentially, you're showing 1% 1971 to today, essentially you have 1% of what you used to have. So you're talking about the 99% currency destruction. And I would just like to truck and trailer a point on the back of that, that the greatest reset moment where a past haircuts, the biggest globalized, synchronized haircut is about to be passed to everybody yet to come. So they're not done stealing from you when they've taken 99%. They want 99% of the remaining 1%. And that's going to come in one sudden moment. So we're probably going to have the harshest devaluation event in terms of still to come off of that 1% in terms of just straight line damage. Wow, that was...
They'd like to take it slowly. That 99%, they'd like to take it over the next 10 years, that next 99%. But of course, as it speeds up, people are going to get wise and they're going to say, I'm not putting up with this. And then we have the crisis and then they're forced to reset. And then they take the 99% in one fell swoop.
Excellent. Any other charts, by the way, while you were there that you wanted to go through? That was interesting.
Okay, well, let's just bear with you for a second. I'll bring up, you might see a number of things flash by as I flick through it, because I put up a number of things here, but bear with me for a second while I bring that up. So we're on that one and where were you? So one of the comments I'd like to make to all your viewers is we've used the word gold and silver a few times. My message is don't put all your eggs in one basket. Have as many baskets as you can possibly find. Now, not every basket's appropriate for everybody. Not everybody can buy property. Not everybody can find a way to buy gold. Not everybody can access the stock market. But not everybody can buy oil or whatever. But you can see there's obviously been things we've done very well in past years. I see that in 2018, your best bet would have been to buy wine. So if you like wine, why not spend some of your money on fine wines and stock up your drink cellar while you can at low prices? But some things which are not on that particular chart are collectibles. I just see if I could bring something up there. I had just bear with you for a second. Just a second. Sorry, just take a second to get
that. No problem. Carry on. We can edit.
So one of the things I think people could consider is this, what you see on the shelf here, collectibles. If you know what you are doing, and I mean seriously know what you're doing, don't buy from an antique shop, don't buy in an auction, you have to buy peer-to-peer. So you buy a peer-to-peer on the websites where people are selling their items. You can become a collector of dolls' houses or soldiers or toy trains and store some value, knowing that you can resell these items peer-to-peer on the same type of website at the same price as you paid for them. But of course, it's not in money. So when they have the reset, if you own a toy train which is worth £150 or a doll's house which is worth £1,000, you'll be able to sell that in the new currency without any problem at all. So collectibles are certainly something people should consider. And again, if they have excess cash, why not a home extension? That picture hasn't come up very large, has it? Well, we'll move on from that one. Or property. Those are some of the things which I think people can consider. Oops, go back here.
What do you think about wealth taxes? Property is not particularly movable. I love the gold price in Argentina pesos while we're there at it. Isn't it unbelievable?
Yeah. So it's high inflation. Everything goes up all of the time.
Yeah, and that's pretty much where we are. But let's talk actually about inflation and disinflation, because the thing that makes me nervous a little bit about collectibles is people will wade in without the knowledge. You put that caveat in. Second of all, if there's going to be a large scale of wealth reduction and a contraction in overall general wealth, most people are going to be poor. We're all going to lose. We all have to still have some money in a bank. At some point, I'm going to lose, be left with old dollars, old pounds, old euros. And just from a functional, transactional, utilitarian point of view, you have to have something in there. So we're all going to lose something. So even people, unless you've got something else that's gone disproportionately up, and I don't think we get those true price mechanisms at the moment in our current structure. Many people will argue paper price of gold's not the real price delivered in your hand, et cetera, et cetera, certainly at a retail level. With a destruction of wealth generally for most people, because most people are going to be captured by this. And those are your future buyers of XYZ collectible. Also be aware that there's going to be a disinflation of assets generally. Because when people are poor, having that unique biscuit tin from 1920s that was charming and all of that, in terms of utility in your daily existence, keeping power on, paying the rent, doing a lot more lower level hierarchy or Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, the basic floor, yep. Far more, I suspect, during the chaos period, because it's not going to be like just switch straight on to a new system. There's going to be this long compression chaos, hurly-burly, where the social unrest, the confusion, the empty shelves, all of this stuff occurs. You really need to know what you're doing. It needs to be high-end, and it needs to be the kind of people that are going to be well-insulated if you're going the collectible route. And I would say make sure rather you have no debt so that you can't be hit by the spike of interest rates. Have things that are readily recognizable as asset holders, precious metals first, rather than biscuit tins or dinky cars, and recognize that many of your future buyers are going to be crushed. So ensure that it's the kind of things that high net worth individuals with well-managed finances are, and even still, many of them will still be crushed, that are your other counterparty in the event of sale as well.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I might have forgotten it. But when this reset happens, we mustn't forget it's a wealth destruction event. A large amount of the fiat assets of the planet will become essentially worthless.
Yeah.
Or they'll be withering away. So they won't be, you can't spend them. And that means asset prices will not be the same. Most likely, most asset prices will be lower in the new currency than they were in the old currency, but they're still going to be a lot better than the alternative of having cash in the bank, which has become worthless or become not usable. So if I say to somebody, think about doing a house extension or buying a property, which I think is a way of deploying surplus cash, you have to remember that you won't necessarily be able to sell that in the new currency for the same number of pounds or dollars that it was worth in the old currency, but as a share of the total wealth on the planet, you will have kept your place in the queue. You wouldn't have gone backwards in the queue because you hold those tangible assets. If you hold fiat assets, your place in the queue will be going backwards.
And the other thing, apart from it being at least preservational to some degree, is that you will birth any sale into the new system, not back into the old. So you will complete the bridging process. Yeah. So this inflation we're going to experience, that's going to be really, really critical. And this asset contraction, it's going to be far faster than people truly, truly, truly realize. And I think it'll feel like we're working for pennies and pounds again. And that's why they'll mask it with the trading of the new system and currency. It will add that confusion element to it. Talk to us about what that means in terms of placement. If there's going to be a massive asset, because the debt dying, which is what's going to happen, is the hypervaluations dying too?
So in terms of placement, we talk about how people should allocate their assets. Is that where you're coming from?
Yes. And this disinflation, yeah. What does it mean?
So, you know, obviously my first comment is you need every type of asset. You need liquid things which you can turn into cash at a known price quickly and easily. And clearly things like gold or silver are things which will always have a known price, which is very easy to trade them in or buy more. So that's a good thing to have. But, you know, and a property at the other end of the scale is very illiquid. So you don't want to have assets which you might need to spend in property. I think I should talk a little bit about the stock market, because I think that's important, and how the currency reset will affect the stock market. Now, this is a personal view, and I might be completely wrong. So,
of course,
markets could do very, very different from what I say. But in the event we have a currency reset, let's start with the man in the street and how this will impact on the stock market. He will have more money in his pocket, assuming his old mortgage is not converted to the new currency. In other words, his old mortgage will be withering away in a currency which is declining in value, the old currency, and he'll have more money to spend in his pocket. Therefore, he'll be spending more in the shops. That's generally good for corporations.
Hey, can I jump in on that? Why are you assuming that they're not going to move banker, given that the bankers are writing the rules, debt into the new money debt system?
So as far as banks are concerned, their books will still be balanced. They have liabilities on one side, which are the deposits you and I have made in the bank, which are not converted. And they have assets on the other side, which is money lent on mortgages. So after a reset, their books will still be balanced. That will be able to continue to operate in the old currency, albeit that both the asset side and the liability side are both going down in value. But the banks will now have a new side of their balance sheet, which is the new currency. So in that respect, it's no different from the situation of banks today, where they hold pounds and they hold dollars, and the value of the dollar or the pound or the euro changes all the time. So if you look at a large UK or Swiss or German bank, they hold a lot of dollars, and they have, whilst their balance sheet might be in Deutschmarks or in euros or in pounds or whatever, they still have the other side of the balance sheet, which is perfectly matched. Assets in dollars match their liabilities in dollars, and they go up and down together, and they have a little bit of exchange profit or a little bit of exchange loss, depending which way it goes, but not much, because they're largely balanced. After the reset, they will still be largely balanced. They'll have two currencies, old pounds, new pounds, old dollars, new dollars. So that isn't the end of the world from the bank's point of view. But over time, the old side of the balance sheet will wither away like Argentinian pesos towards nothing, and the new side, the new currency, will rise in value as people deploy their wealth into the new asset, into the new currency. So I don't see that the banks, and by the way, it wouldn't make any sense at all from a government perspective in a reset to say, oh, everybody's mortgage is converted to the new currency, because basically once you're creating the liability for the people in the new currency, you're creating the asset in the new currency, and it's the currency itself which is causing the problem. So it makes no sense to convert it.
No, you're right on that point. So I think if it's occurred in the old game, it's probably going to have to stay in the old game. So actually, those that are asset heavy, but the problem, the only issue, the vulnerability is the interest rate thing that we've got to keep remembering. Assuming they survive the old money demands of a spiked interest rate during the problem phase. So we essentially have the old system, then we have this beginning of a problem and this interim period, and then we have the full new system running to two forks, similar, you know, the Ethereum Classic and the Ethereum, the fork, and then they taper the one off. During that period, we're going to have probably the spike in interest rates. So that's going to see the BlackRocks of this world accumulate farmland, properties, retail, residentials, and all of these things. We're probably going to see new watermelon communism rules on heating and then things in your home that would require those that survive to make massive investment to ensure that they get a 9 out of 10, you know, watermelon communism score, no leaks, heat, etc. And then we come into the new system where most people are rentiers. Talk about property. How should people make sure they survive these three stages to the new system, which will then have the duality of both currencies?
Ideally, if you have a mortgage, it should be at a fixed rate of interest. And I think in many parts of the world, that's very easy to do. And I constantly hear about people who are taking out mortgages. I say, get your rate of interest fixed. I think most of them do, and if they can fix it for a long time, they tend to do so. So you don't really have a problem if your mortgage rate is fixed.
This contract's reneged on, and that's the only point, because you think you have it. It's like the FIDIC, you know, well, my balances are guaranteed at 100,000. This whole period is counterparty reneging, deception, and who could have seen this? You know, like Greenspan said, the black swan that was subprime, as if it was a totally unpredictable thing. Are we not going to get this narrative? And most contractual elements could be reneged on as well. You know, they could say, listen, you're still observing your fix for this period, but the market has had such extreme premiums. We have to put in a collar repayment in here that compensates. We can't do this. The debt markets have changed. This is government law. Lots of media, new, and just put a charge on. Is it not possible?
Well, first of all, things can happen very, very quickly. So it'll be more of a mess after the reset as people argue about which way the wind blows and what has happened. But let's say we go into this high interest rate environment. If you have a variable rate of interest, it's going to hurt. And if you are renewing if you have a fixed term loan and it's coming to maturity and it comes to maturity at the wrong moment when interest rates are high, that will hurt. In many places, you can affix your renewal rate up to a year, sometimes 6 months, in advance of the maturity date. You just have to talk to your financial provider to agree that. Say, I'd like to agree that. I personally have done it. My mortgage, I keep my mortgages in six slices, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year, 6 year, like that. And every year when there's a slice comes due, I 3 or 6 months before it matures, I discuss with the bank and get it an agreed interest rate, which is then applied. So I know where it's coming. If we do get into this spike of high interest rates, I would like to think it doesn't last too long, but we don't know that. Usually when interest rates go very, very high and there's a crisis in the bond market, as there would be, governments are their hand is forced to act very quickly. So it may not last that long. So if you're paying 100% a year in interest, but you only have to pay it for a week, well, that's only going to cost you 2%. So it's not that much, but obviously it hurts. But if you have to pay it for a whole year, well, you're bankrupt.
Yeah.
That's usually
why I think it could be prolonged.
Yeah,
because it's part of getting that final 1% of value that they have. They want to own everything, I have a feeling, with this World Economic Forum doctrine. But anyway, sorry, carry on.
I think another point is if you're entering into a contract of any description, you might want to be thinking about putting in a currency reset clause. What happens if you've agreed something and we have a reset before the action, the contract, is fulfilled? So you might be buying a house, you might be selling a house. Now, I haven't seen any currency reset clauses myself, but certainly if I was transacting in a let's say I'm buying a machine to be delivered in 1 year's time, I might want to put in a clause to say that if the currency is reset in some way, I can cancel the contract, or maybe if I'm the seller, I want to cancel the contract, and if I'm the buyer, I want to keep the contract in the old currency. But I certainly think it's a good idea to think about currency reset clauses in contracts. Having said that, I think if we do have a currency reset, it is very likely a law will be passed saying that all unfulfilled contracts are automatically converted to the new currency. Probably. That would seem the most logical way to proceed if I was a government. But all fulfilled contracts, such as a loan you took out 5 years ago, stay behind.
Yeah.
If we look at past resets and see what changed. In the past, salaries moved to the new currency. Taxes moved to the new currency. Shop prices moved to the new currency. And funnily enough, rents moved to the new currency. Now, we all know who the landowners are.
Yeah.
So that explains why the rents moved to the new currency. So those are the kind of things which probably would move over. But of course, we must remember there's over 100 countries which might at some point do a reset. And they'll make up their own rules in each current country. So it might be different depending on where people live and how they implement the rules.
And okay, so actually the debt, so you could lever up by an investment portfolio with rentals, and you could bridge as another bridging asset. You could have old money debt that gets tapered in value, and you could have new money income.
I'm sure there'll be plenty of people thinking about that kind of way. Yes.
Again, the interest rate risk. So if you're a cash guy and you can buy cash, you're probably safe. The interest rate risk the minute you lever is, again, the big spoiler, which is why I think we will have a spike in craziness for a sustained period. They need to wash people out.
Just returning a little bit to the stock market, I did touch on this. I said people have more money in their pocket to spend because they are no longer servicing as much of their mortgage, which is withering away in the old currency. But we've also got the corporations who have issued bonds. So corporations have issued bonds in the old currency, contractually the old currency. They'll stay in the old currency, in my view, and there's no point in them moving across, otherwise you destroy the point of a reset. So if your bonds are in the old currency, those companies are going to have an exchange profit booked to their profit and loss year after year as the old currency withers away. It's almost as if they'd borrowed money in Turkish lira or Argentinian pesos or Brazilian real. That currency is going down in value, and that is a profit that they can book to their profit and loss, boosting their earnings for as long as the currency until it's reached zero, which again is potentially quite good for the way people will look at stocks, because they'll have more earnings per share and potentially more dividends.
Yes, but retail will be crushed. So if it's Apple Computer, which you had as a logo, it might not be as good because they'll be selling less devices. But if it's a business to government or a military industrial complex or something that relies on something that's always going to be spent, that could be a very interesting sector of the market then.
Well, there's the dilemma, but we mustn't forget that where we are right now, the US government has run out of money, hit the debt ceiling. And as of today, I would be concerned about the impact of that on companies which rely heavily on government spending, like infrastructure or defense companies and those sort of things. One has to be a little bit conscious that it's not a one-way ticket here.
In fact, we're going to have austerity plus, I expect, for a while out of governments until the dust and the confusion settles. So business to business, maybe I should have said instead, where it's a real reliance service. It's a service that must be had. So kind of electricity, maybe your utilities become interesting or something like that. But they do a lot of retail as well. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting thought. I don't actually know the full answer on that. So stock markets, but that doesn't make it a bull stock market on its own, because you're going to have retail contraction of such a degree, I'm imagining. I mean, when they introduced the euro, for example, everybody got an inflation spike, in essence. Their old money lost its buying power substantially. Everyone got I mentioned that one, not because it was a reset, it wasn't, but in a way it was a conversion to a currency. And you talk to an Italian or a Spaniard or anybody, there was an impoverishment effect in that introduction of the new currency, and prices generally went up as well across. So inflation, it was inflationary. But it was inflationary, it was stagflationary probably. So things felt more expensive and people had less money to spend. That's not a particularly good environment for retail consumer stocks, certainly. So any comment on that element?
It's not just the sales and the profits which determine the value of a stock, at least not in the short term. In the long term, yes. But let's go back to some of the resets of the past. Certainly in many of the situations, ahead of the reset, we had people who saw what was coming and they bought into the stock market. I'll give you a small example. There was a bit of a panic, or a lot of a panic, in the Great Recession in the USA in 1933. And what was going to come in April, on the 5th of April, they were going to close the gold window, so Americans had to turn in their gold coins. Some people had a notion something bad was going to happen. So by February, several months before, they were queuing up at the banks to get their money out, and Roosevelt closed the banks for a week. Or 2 weeks, actually, and the stock exchange was similarly closed. As on the day the stock market reopened, it had the biggest one-day rise in all of history. And it then went on to have the largest, over the next 3 or 4 months, the fastest 100% rise in all of history. And what was coming after that, 6-9 months later, after they closed the gold window, was the devaluation of the dollar by 58% this single day on the 31st of January 1934, when the dollar was devalued by 58% against all foreign currencies and against gold on that day as well. And people who'd positioned themselves in the stock market actually did quite well out of that, because American goods and services were now particularly attractive worldwide. Obviously, it wasn't like today, where we have a very, very interconnected economy, and not many people were affected by the devaluation because people were domestically invested in their own currency. But it is entirely possible that even if we have lower sales and lower profits, that we might see a PE expansion causing prices to rise a lot, because people will be looking at where their money is. They might not be happy. We don't know how happy they'll be with the new system. You know, on the other hand, people who've got stock market investments won't have any cash because they haven't been, their cash hasn't been converted, so they'll be sellers. So it could go either way. I don't want to say it's not a one-way ticket. It could go either way. I personally think it's a way of storing wealth, because if you own equities, and I do like commodity companies, which are in the mining businesses, because they've got real tangible assets. But most companies have got property of various descriptions, and many companies have got very wide margins where they have annuity type revenues. I don't think you and I are going to stop spending money on many of the online things we have. You know, we're going to continue to watch our movies. We're going to continue to pay for our software. These are annuity type revenues, and those companies will still be there. Whether the price of the shares is higher or lower, that's neither here nor there. What's important, your share of the total wealth on the planet has been maintained if you own a mixture of the tangible assets on the planet, one of which is the stock market.
Yep. Wealth taxes. So stock market, it could be a good preservational play, but you don't want to be a forced seller. So if you're underprepared in cash in any other arena, I suspect many retails will be pushed into the category of forced seller. But if you can survive the flush out of leverage, it could be a very good preservational thing. Now let's talk geographies, because the US stock market is highly stretched on PEs with a boomer demographic, and you have other regions. So is there not going to be a pivoting and a revaluation? Would you have it in trackers on America, or would you prefer somewhere else?
The world is a very large place, and throughout the world, you can find pockets of value and areas which are too expensive. I personally feel that even the tech sector, which has come down an awful lot in the United States, is too expensive for my liking. That hasn't always been the case, but right now, despite the huge drop we've seen in tech stocks, I find it too expensive. But when I look outside of that sector, it's possible to find companies which don't seem too overvalued, but the prices or the price earnings ratios are higher, perhaps on a like-for-like basis, than some other places. So what I would say to anybody who's investing, try and be globally diversified. Don't overweight the USA. It's generally an expensive market. Make sure that what you own isn't heavily invested in the top 10 companies. And so if you own an ETF, which is tracking a mainstream index, it will be heavily invested in the top 10 companies. Try and find mid caps, small caps, or markets where there's not too much market dominance. But certainly, I don't think it's wrong to have a lot of exposure to Europe. And we have to say that Asia, particularly Hong Kong, is very, very cheap at the moment. And there are reasons for that. Obviously, because people are worried about which way China will go, there could be potentially a blockade at some point of Taiwan. And we all know that if they blockade Taiwan, there'll be a standoff with the Americans to see if anyone dares to fire the first shot. And they'll be saying to the Taiwanese, you need our permission to go in or out, come to the negotiating table. And obviously we can all guess what follows from Taiwan. It's Okinawa. So that's maybe a 20-year point of view. But that's perhaps one of the reasons why Asian stocks are very cheap now, because people fear the sanctions which might come if we have a geopolitical incident concerning Taiwan.
Yeah, I think Jim Rickard's on Sold Out. feels that they will never actually make that move because the repercussions on trade would be extensively destructive. So it's almost a boogeyman that keeps money out that actually prevents you possibly from actually getting an undervalued market. I had something that I did on a predecessor, and you can mention, we discussed this just before we began the chat, but it might be interesting to have a look at. In fact, I'll go with it, this Dow chart first, but it's actually the Excel sheet I was looking for, that one. And I was mentioning to you the total value of by market cap of the states versus the rest of the other investable nations, divided by the population, as a because I think macro demographics are so important. And I'm not just is the screen showing there for you? Hopefully, it is.
We can see it. Yeah, it's the right way. Good, right? Good.
Yeah, market cap in billions. So that's 40 trillion for America, and divided by their population, you have $119,000 per citizen is having to maintain that market cap. And then we did China, which has an 11 trillion market cap per citizen is $7,700. That includes Hong Kong, Shenzhen, and Shanghai. India is 2.7, which I was shocked how low India was ranked, actually, because I think of the, you know, the competence in the tech space, $2.7 trillion and just $2,000. It's also low per person because they also have 1.4 billion people. We can't forget that we're dividing by a very large number there. Russia is sitting at a 447, which is under half a trillion. About $3,000 a citizen. They have 125 million odd people. Brazil is 200, and let's get the number right, 218 to Russia's 147. So you have Brazil at about 2,400. I think of them a lot in agri's sense. Brazil, it's a bit of a simplification. And then we had South Africa on 0.8 of a trillion with $12,000. And then another mature market with an even worse demographic than the States and Europe, Japan, with about a $5 trillion and $39,000 per person. And then I took all the BRICS added together, and we have the total BRICS market cap is $15.5 trillion with about an aggregate of $4,700 a head. And I just, when I look at this, I just have a feeling that tech is going to flow out to other areas. America is going to cease to be the sole emerger of technical innovations and NASDAQ listings. And this post-reset period is likely to see a capital formation starting to drift. And it'll take time. It's not going to be overnight, but into possibly more the Indian market, I think on the commodity side, the Russian market, possibly on agris and other things like copper and various other things, South American. And you'll also have a dissipation from Japan into the BRICS as well a little bit, whether it's various, because they're going to be net sellers. They are heavily exposed to debt. They bought all their own debt. The reset in Japan, in terms of some of the things we've been discussing, is literally going to submit. I mean, culturally, the men give the money to the woman and the woman buy the Japanese bonds, don't they? That's a bit a simplification of the narrative. So imagine what that's going to mean outside of their homes, their retirements and the UBI that's going to be required. How does some of your thinking and the global flow of money, because essentially you can build wealth if you go to the places where the money is flowing to, typically, and that even a simple tracker. I have a little bit of we like the Singapore Straight Index technically, and I have a little bit of a thought that the sanitized version of China and where listings for people that are not Chinese will springboard into China could be Singapore, and that we'll see the flow, the Switzerland of the East be Singapore. So you could also have some Indian companies that might have a listing there and other places. Indonesia, incredible demographics and potential growth. So tell us a little on the macro flows of money.
Well, you mentioned Singapore. Obviously, there are already plenty of non-Singapore companies which are classifying themselves as Singaporeans and listing on the Singapore Stock Exchange. So you might have palm oil producers in Indonesia who are listed on the Singapore Stock Exchange. And it's inevitable that the Chinese money is going to be looking for homes. Obviously, Hong Kong still will be popular with the mainland Chinese, but many of them will choose other locations in the world as well. It hasn't gone particularly well for them when they chose the USA. So Singapore, I think, is a likely choice. As far as global flows of money are concerned, the USA is still a very large economy and China is up and coming. I think if we look at the near term, next few years, we've just had the lockdowns in China and repressions in a certain sense coming to an end. And once again, Chinese are allowed to travel. So I think in the next year or two, we'll see quite a wave of people and money coming out of China to resettle in other parts of the world. And with that, some Chinese type businesses. But what I think people should be doing is put your money into as many industries as you can find, as many countries as you can find. Try and adopt a Warren Buffett type approach. Buy your growth at the lowest possible price you can find. And there are plenty of tools which you can get, both free ones and more expensive ones. But when I say more expensive, absolutely cheaper than a Netflix subscription, which will help you find the individual companies you can invest in. I'm not a great fan of investing in funds. And as far as ETFs are concerned, I think it's only if you really can't be bothered to do the homework yourself. But at the end of the day, most funds managed professionally fail to beat the benchmark over any reasonable period of time. So if you can choose some solid companies with good revenues, a high margin, that means the difference between what they are selling their goods for and what they buy them for. So I'll give you an example. Amazon is not high margin. It's very low margin. But there are companies like Apple or Microsoft who have got very high margins. So, and not, by the way, these are not recommendations. Just clarify, I'm not giving investment advice. Yeah, it's just to say as illustrations. If you can buy high margin companies with stable revenues, annuity-like revenues, at a reasonable price, and that's a very important point, I think you'll do better than the indices over time. What you should not do is become a trader where you buy something and try and sell it 10% higher next month or next year. That every time you trade, there's a lot of frictional cost and you're probably going to lose money. But if you buy a blue chip collection, you'll probably do very well over the next decades.
And the Middle East, we spoke of Singapore. The Middle East, the sort of, let's say, Israel as a tech hub, Qatar, there seems to be, I remember the world, you know, so the Eiffel Tower was the tallest tower, and then, you know, America had to go and do this. Now that ambition seems to be very much in the Middle East. You know, they recently, I don't see it as coincidental that Qatar spent 10 times. Russia spent $18 billion on the last World Cup. Qatar spent $200 billion. MBS is sanitizing back Saudi Arabia away from the old god and some of the more medieval aspects. There seems to be a thing growing. I've even heard that brings us some of the most work they're doing on transporting bullion is Swiss gold going to Dubai, Qatar, and various activities. Is there a capital formation going on in the Middle East around Saudi, Israel, and that larger Qatari conurbation, and its place in the Belt and Road as well as an extra?
In general, these are relatively small markets at the moment, and in general, they're rather difficult to access for most people. The way I access these smaller and less accessible markets is via specialized funds which invest in these areas, because you can't go and buy 10 Saudi companies because otherwise you've got 10 Saudi companies, you've got 10 Qatar companies, you've got 10 companies in India, and then you're up with 4,000 companies around the world. You don't want to do that. So when you have a market which is particularly small and or relatively inaccessible, it's a lot easier to get a diversification through a single ETF, an ETF or through a specialized investment company which specializes in this area.
But what's your view on that?
You've got to have a bit of everything. But don't be overweight anywhere. And don't forget, as it's a small part of the world, you don't want to make it the bulk of your portfolio unless you want to take that kind of bet.
I just think as an aggressive growth area, it might turn out, along with Singapore, quite an interesting area. It's part of the move east. Excellent. Anything else with regards to the reset that we haven't touched on? We've gone on a lot of amazing topics, and I've really enjoyed this, Clive. What message would you have, or anything else you would like to mention in terms of, A, we've got, we actually, by the way, today, no less, because you are a man of Britain, we did have some UK-based, let me just find news. I think we're expecting PPI, flash manufacturing PMIs and flash services. We have a lot of UK followers. What's your outlook for the UK? The PMIs came in slightly above, the services PMI slightly under, the manufacturing slightly above, the services slightly under. It looks like a damn squid. What's your take on the United Kingdom's positioning, and especially in lieu of the bond crisis that it had recently in gilts that's precipitated on the pound, and then subsequently we've seemed to have partially recovered? Is that going to re-emerge as a threat, do you think?
UK finances are not in a particularly good shape. I think that's negative for the pound against everything. That doesn't mean to say I wouldn't invest in the UK, because when you invest in tangible assets like the stock market or property, that should do the opposite of what the currency does. So I'm not saying people shouldn't invest in the UK. Certainly they should, but I don't think I would be buying any gilt-edged securities, and I wouldn't be putting my money on deposit in pounds. That I don't think makes a lot of sense. But if I lived in England, yes, you must have your pounds in the bank in case you need to spend them. But by the same token, don't have all your eggs in one asset. Don't have it all in fiat of any currency.
Yeah, excellent. So final advice and final thoughts for the viewers in terms of timing and when. Do you have a view on a time, and then what should they be doing? Just your five rule thumb.
I used to say a few years ago, we've probably got another 10 years of life or so in the currency we have at the moment. I've shortened that. I think it's probably about, I'll say not more than 3 years. But for all I know, we might run into a crisis in the next 3 months. It might be on Monday. You never know, because these things come from nowhere. Nobody rings a bell when there's a black swan event and suddenly we wake up. We get, you know, when people are queuing up outside Northern Rock Building Society to get their money out, or Bear Stones, or any of these other companies which went bust over time, nobody rang a bell before it happened and said, hey, everybody, here's a few weeks advance warning. So when it comes, it will come quickly. So my message is, prepare yourself slowly and gradually now, so that you don't have to do things in a rush at the last minute, when people are queuing up outside the shops to get their tinned food.
100%. And it goes as far as that. You know, food, water, energy, supplies, alternatives, backups, full prepping in terms of your view as well?
I certainly think you should spend money on things that you might need in the future, whether that's tools or an exercise bike. If you're thinking of buying one, why not spend the money now? If you need firewood, why not buy it now? I'm not saying people should hoard tinned food, but you know, if you have cash and you don't have the courage to go into financial assets like gold, silver, stock market, and you haven't got the money to go into property, and you can't afford a house extension, you can't afford a loft conversion, well, you know, buy the things you might want to buy next year. Buy them now.
Yeah. Very good. I like that. Get into your physical items that you may need that will serve you well into that. Clive, it's been awesome. Is there a way that people can communicate with you or stay in touch by preference, or should they just follow the YouTubes?
Anybody who wants to contact me is free to do so via LinkedIn. That's, I think, the only practical way to get hold of me these days. I mean, you know what email is like. It's absolutely overwhelmed. The good thing about LinkedIn is you can, if people become annoying in advertising terms, you can just simply report them and it's done and it's gone. Whereas with email, the box is full. So LinkedIn would be the way.
Email is dead app. Excellent. So go look for Clive Thompson on LinkedIn. Thank you very much for your time. I thoroughly enjoyed the chat today. I think there's much more to come out. We'll probably end up hopefully scheduling again in the not too distant future as things develop. Parting shot, the petrodollar, the Saudis have actually said they'll accept other currencies. Is that the great unraveling of the parting question of the petrodollar? Is it a shoe to drop for you, Clive?
Well, I don't know if you've been reading about what's called the R5. Have you heard this word? The R5? Does that mean?
No, the Five Eyes, is that?
Okay. So there's a lot. It's sort of coming in as a concept. There's a new word, the R5, referring to five currencies which are going to form a currency block, or maybe a new currency. But the R5 would be a currency which is linked to the Saudi riyal, the currency names, the Russian ruble, the South African rand, the Chinese renminbi, and the Brazilian real. Five R's.
The five R's. So there you go.
I don't know if it will get traction, but obviously there's the talk about the BRICS currency as well. We'll see. It could take some years to come, and it will all depend on whether people trust it and whether it's convertible and whether they trust the convertibility.
Well, I learned a new phrase today. Clive, thank you very much. It's been awesome having you on, and have a great day. And we look forward to, we'll get this out as soon as possible, and we look forward to the responses therein and having you back on sometime.
My pleasure.
And all the best to you. Bye-bye.